Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com. You can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Radio Havana Cuba, and Sputnik Radio. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The COVID pandemic has transformed the streets of Brussels into a more climate-friendly place with more space for pedestrians and bicycles. Protests against government restrictions in response to the pandemic are growing in Germany, with the far-right and conspiracy theorists trying to hijack the demonstrations. Russia now has the second largest number of COVID infections, and Santiago, Chile has gone into total lockdown. U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo spent a day in Israel, where Netanyahu and Benny Gantz have formed a unity government. They discussed the pandemic and the annexation of parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Fierce clashes are continuing in Yemen, backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The coronavirus has transformed our everyday lives, but it's also transforming our cities and how we get around. The pandemic is inspiring a push for climate-friendly mobility with more space for people and bikes and less for cars. We take you now to Belgium's capital, Brussels.
It's early morning. Brussels is still asleep as its traffic revolution begins. 170 signs are put up, explaining that pedestrians and cyclists now have priority across the central part of the city. We've noticed that the measures we're introducing to reduce traffic are making the city more resilient at a time when we're fighting a pandemic. We want to give pedestrians and cyclists more space, and that makes our city more livable, healthier, safer. Traffic lights in central Brussels have been virtually switched off because pedestrians and cyclists now have right of way, and they're allowed to use the entire road. Cars and buses have to respect a 20 kilometer per hour speed limit. The new traffic rules are intended to help people comply with social distancing.
As a cyclist, you feel that there's not always place for you in the city, especially in the big streets. There's not a there's no cycling routes, no protection for the cyclists, and you see that's a lot. There is a lot of aggression against cyclists.
It's a good thing for the quality of life in the city if bicycles get more space. Life is starting to pick up again in Belgium after the pandemic lockdown. Shops are allowed to open. People are meeting up again, though everything is at a distance and under strict hygiene rules. Face masks are mandatory in buses, trams, and subways. They're being sold in vending machines as well, 5 masks for 7 euros. COVID-19 forced life in Brussels to come to a halt for 2 months, time the city spent overhauling its traffic policy to make it more friendly to cyclists. And now that the city is beginning to wake up again, it's likely that these changes will survive the pandemic.
And here's a report about protests in different German cities against measures being taken to keep the pandemic under control.
Germany hadn't witnessed scenes like this in weeks. Thousands gathered at an official demonstration in downtown Stuttgart last weekend, calling for greater freedoms during the corona pandemic, despite a recent loosening of restrictions.
I think the way they're dealing with this pandemic is a bit over the top, driving the whole country into the ground.
Putting 83 million healthy people in lockdown and winding the economy down, that's never happened before.
Das ist ja was, das gab's noch überhaupt nicht.
We're here to show that we're not outsiders. People here aren't from the Green Party or eco-freaks or hippies or from the Alternative for Germany or whatever. We're normal people from the middle of society. We act responsibly and we always have done. We're responsible citizens.
The demonstration is loud but peaceful, and most here respect the social distancing rule. But protests like this one have also attracted people who are using the crisis to promote their own cause, among them conspiracy theorists and extremists, according to Judith Rahner.
I wasn't in Stuttgart, I was in Berlin. And it's clear to see that the number of people trying to hijack the demonstration, especially right-wing extremists, is far higher in Berlin than in Stuttgart.
At an unauthorized demonstration in central Berlin, things got out of hand. Anti-vaxxers, conspiracy theorists, and right-wing hooligans were among the crowd. The German government has expressed concern that violent right-wing extremists could sway opinion, especially among those doubting the validity of the current restrictions. Further large demonstrations have been announced for this weekend.
Russia has the world's second highest number of coronavirus infections, after reporting just under 11,000 new cases on Tuesday. The country's total is now more than 230,000. Officials say the high numbers are the result of a huge testing campaign. The death rate there still remains relatively low.
Chile's government has ordered a total lockdown of the capital Santiago after a spike in coronavirus cases. Infections jumped by 60% in just 24 hours. The vast majority of cases in Chile are in Santiago. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has left Israel after a one-day state visit. Pompeo held meetings with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his new governing partner, Benny Gantz. They discussed efforts to fight the COVID-19 pandemic as well as security issues related to Iran. Pompeo's visit comes a day before Israel's new unity government is scheduled to be sworn in. The challenge of tackling the coronavirus has played a part in ending an extended political deadlock in the country.
Three times they ran against each other as fierce political rivals, Benjamin Netanyahu for the conservative Likud party and Benny Gantz from the centrist Blue and White party. But what three inconclusive elections couldn't solve, the corona crisis now has. The leaders agreed to form a national emergency government to deal with the pandemic. The new unity government is to be led by Netanyahu for the first 18 months, Gantz for the second. Its initial focus, the coronavirus. But political battles are far from over. A protest against Netanyahu in front of his residence in Jerusalem. Netanyahu has been indicted on corruption charges. His trial, already postponed once, is expected to start in 2 weeks. He denies the allegations. Aside from the pandemic, the new coalition agreement singled out one other major policy issue, the annexation of parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In January, U.S. President Donald Trump released his controversial Vision for Peace proposal. Now Israel's new government could pass legislation to annex Israeli settlements and the Jordan Valley as early as July. Settler leader David El-Khayani wants that to happen as soon as possible, but rejects the notion of a future Palestinian state included in the Trump proposal.
In July, sovereignty should be applied over the Jordan Valley, the northern Dead Sea area, and the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, regardless of Trump's plan. It's a dangerous plan that will result in the formation of a Palestinian terror state, and we won't allow that to happen.
A joint U.S.-Israel mapping team is reportedly working on outlining the details. The scope and timing of any annexation is still unclear, but it would make a future sovereign Palestinian state even more elusive.
Officials in Yemen say at least 12 people died in fierce clashes in the southern province of Abyan on Tuesday. Fighting broke out between Saudi-backed government troops and separatists backed by the United Arab Emirates. The two sides were allies until separatists declared self-rule last month.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. DW is producing excellent virus reports daily in English, which you can easily find at dw.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The United States vetoed a resolution sponsored by France and Tunisia aimed at a global ceasefire that had been unanimously approved by every other country on the UN Security Council. The British medical journal The Lancet had an editorial stating that Brazilian President Bolsonaro was the greatest threat to controlling the rapidly spreading pandemic in his country. The Cuban foreign minister held a press conference concerning U.S. government silence about the terrorist attack on the Cuban embassy in Washington. The Venezuelan government apprehended 8 more mercenaries involved in the recently failed attempt to kidnap President Maduro. Then a viewpoint on Operation Gideon, an attempted coup against Maduro, led by a consortium of private American mercenaries and Juan Guaido. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The international community is demanding an end to war, and the United States is vetoing. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel said that once again, imperial arrogance and hegemony is pitted against the world's will. On his official Twitter account, Díaz-Canel referred to the recent decision of the United States to block the vote at the United Nations Security Council on a resolution aimed at a global ceasefire during the COVID-19 pandemic. The excuse given by Washington to prevent this initiative was that the document contained a mention of the WHO, the World Health Organization. The draft resolution, sponsored by France and Tunisia, called for a cessation of hostilities in areas of armed conflict and a humanitarian pause so that governments could better deal with the consequences of the pandemic. The resolution was supported by all members of the UN Security Council, with the only exception being the United States. The UN Security Council was responding to a call for an immediate global ceasefire made by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in March. This diplomatic action leaves the United States once again totally isolated from the international community after President Donald Trump announced on April the 14th the suspension of his country's funds to the WHO in the midst of a fight against a world pandemic. The biggest threat to Brazil's ability to successfully combat the spread of the coronavirus and tackle the ongoing public health crisis is the country's president, Bolsonaro, according to the British medical journal, The Lancet. In an editorial, The Lancet said that Bolsonaro's disregard for and flouting of lockdown measures is sowing confusion across Brazil, which is now recording record numbers of COVID-19 cases and deaths, and is fast emerging Brazil as one of the world's coronavirus hottest hotspots. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez held a virtual press conference in Havana Tuesday afternoon, taking questions from national and international news correspondents accredited here in Havana after he made a declaration. Cuba's top diplomat strongly denounced the attack on our embassy in Washington, D.C., which occurred on April the 30th. Bruno Rodriguez said there has yet to be an official statement from the Donald Trump administration, and it took 5 days before the State Department even made a statement. He questioned why the United States maintains silence over the terrorist action. During the virtual press conference, which was broadcast on Cuban radio and television and transmitted on Facebook, Twitter, and other social networks, the Cuban foreign minister said that the attack on the island's embassy in Washington, D.C. cannot be separated from the constant attacks by U.S. administrations over the years against the Cuban Revolution. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez outlined the personal background of the 42-year-old man who attacked the embassy in Washington, D.C. with an AK-47 rifle. The Cuban-born Alexander Alazo Baró has lived for some time in the United States, but occasionally visited his native Cuba. During the press conference, surveillance video was shown of Alexander Lasso shooting at the Cuban embassy in the early morning hours of Thursday, April the 30th. While the Cuban government is working to obtain more information on this terrorist attack and the individual who carried it out, the Cuban foreign minister called on the United States to cooperate with Cuban authorities in the investigation and guarantee security for the island's diplomatic personnel in the United States, both in Washington and New York, at the Cuban mission to the United Nations. The Venezuelan government announced on Sunday that its special forces apprehended 8 more mercenaries with ties to the foiled May 3rd plot in the northern state of Aragua, which is near Caracas. The arrest of these Venezuelan deserters is part of the deployment carried out by state security forces to capture the mercenaries involved in the failed operation, which tried to carry out a coup in the nation and kidnap President Nicolas Maduro. The Venezuelan National Police reported that search and capture operations for the rest of those involved in the failed plot are still ongoing. 14 mercenaries were captured over the weekend. So far, nearly 30 linked to those events have been arrested, including 2 former United States Green Beret, Luke Alexander Denman and Arian Berry. Both of them appeared before Venezuelan courts over the weekend.
The Operation Gideon, an enormous fiasco through which the puppet men of the United States in Venezuela, Juan Guaido, intended to overthrow the legitimate president of the Bolivarian nation, has been described by the media as a private coup. As usual, the press helps Washington clean up the disaster area, a proper name to this action that was apparently led only by the Venezuelan opposition and a private consortium of the American security. The very name of the military action implies their belief. According to the Bible, Gideon was a warrior called by God to save his people besieged by the Midianites. With only 300 men, he destroyed an army of 1,000 men in one night. And at the same time, he redeemed the Israelites who had turned away from the worship of Jehovah. The metaphor used goes well with their goals, but the brilliant theater presentation, firstly conceived as a heroic act, became a shoddy comedy because the new Gideon, the Canadian-American mercenary Jordan Goodreau, would not continue after the first act, despite the signing of a $212 million deal that would be repaid with oil. It's known that Goodreau was part of the special troops of the Pentagon in Afghanistan and Iraq, and once retired, he created in Miami the private security company Silver Cup. That's the place where Guaido's political consultant, Mr. Juan José Rendón, now separated from office, signed a contract consisting of 3 stages. The first stage would be to train those who would directly perform the operation, then eliminate or capture President Maduro, and in case of the latter, put him on a plane to the United States. In the third moment, Silver Cup would have 450 days, extendable, to stabilize the country, that is, to erase any sign of socialism or Chavism in the Venezuelan territory, plus a year of persecution, arrests, torture, and murders. Although denied by Donald Trump and his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, this plan would have been impossible if the U.S. authorities were not involved, mainly because Guaido would never do anything without the consent of his masters. Where did the alleged plane to transfer the president to the North come from? As far as it's known, Silver Cup does not have such equipment. In this regard, Pompeo declared that if they had participated directly in action, it wouldn't have failed. Is it possible that he already forgot what happened in Vietnam?
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well this week at their website, radiohc.cu, and their podcast links remain fixed and are working great. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help me keep going like listeners to KMUD in Redway and KHPD in Modesto, California did this week. If you are interested in how I created the Shortwave Report 24 years ago, I was the guest on a recent edition of a podcast called Humboldt Lighthouse. We will conclude with Sputnik Radio. On this program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi interviewed Frank Jürgen Richter, former director of the World Economic Forum. They discuss the impact coronavirus will have on the European Union's unity, the possibility of class warfare and revolutions in the West comparable to Russia in 1917 and France in 1798, anti-establishment sentiment as a result of globalization, and how uncontrolled capitalism has created the conditions for mass social unrest amid COVID-19. Sputnik Radio.
With the UK death toll now the worst in Europe, could we see a revolution everywhere to rival Russia's 1917 revolution? Joining me now via Skype from Zurich is the chairman of think tank Horasis, Dr. Frank Jürgen Richter. Do you think there are dangers of social unrest because of coronavirus?
You know, already prior to the COVID crisis, globalization has left a great portion of British and other Western society impoverished. An uncontrolled form of capitalism favoring the richest few has increasingly diminished the middle class. And the deep-seated resentment of globalization is boiling over worldwide. A great portion of the world perceives themselves to be globalization losers, and social welfare systems have not kept pace with globalization.
Do you think austerity policies could push Europe, European countries, maybe Britain, to revolutions on the level of France in 1789 and Russia in 1917 and China in 1949?
Already last year, prior to COVID, the French Yellow West protesters spilled into the streets of Paris. And we've seen similar protests in the UK and around the globe. And the middle class wants to benefit from economic growth, just as elites do. And I would even say that Trump's rise to power is based on this resentment. He was mostly elected by globalization losers. And finally, yes, I think we might face another revolution, and maybe something similar to the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution.
What do you think it'll look like? Because presumably the rich feel they can lock themselves away in ivory towers. They can use private infrastructure, whether it be water or basic amenities, and ignore the masses.
Well, a lot of rich Londoners fled the coronavirus and now sitting in their nice castle and mansions somewhere in the north. Whereas we have unrest in poorer cities, in poorer regions in the UK and across Europe. The coronavirus is really highlighting the UK's stark divide, unemployment, the lack of healthcare, and threats to social safety nets due to COVID may fuel outrage.
Don't you think that a media here, run by oligarchs, can hide some of this from the general public, or at least from the policymakers and decision makers, so we don't fully understand the world the way you see it?
Well, the media has a very important role to play here. And think about, you know, spending now the trillions of euros, pounds and dollars. Where should the money come from? And I think the plan B is indeed austerity, but austerity won't work this time. We have to revive our economies. We have to help the poorer parts of society. And we are maybe facing even class warfare in UK, Europe, and in America. I guess the minorities are dying at twice the rate of their white peers. So that's really alarming.
Well, perhaps there is some realization of what you're talking about as regards class warfare, because elites in NATO countries are very aware, perhaps, of this instability, and they are blaming Britain's secret services, for instance, blaming sabotage of healthcare services here from Russia, from China, from Iran, who knows, Venezuela, who knows, Cuba. And as you know, Donald Trump sees coronavirus as a direct attack on par with Pearl Harbor and 9/11 from the People's Republic of China.
Well, yeah, he's making this comparison between Pearl Harbor and the coronavirus, and I think it's a wrong thing to do. It's totally different, and I don't believe the virus comes from a lab in Wuhan. It's definitely not a good time to pick another fight with China. So the U.S. would definitely amplify the current economic downturn by applying tariffs to punish China for its role in the health crisis. Think about, you know, the Great Depression of which started in 28-29. At the time, most countries were very protectionist, accelerating the depression, accelerating the economic crisis, and the same thing might happen again.
Yeah, but arguably with £645 billion of quantitative easing here, the governments, at the same time as they may be blaming China, are pouring money into firms that are committed to globalization, supporting your viewpoint. And if it doesn't work, surely natural they should blame bad actors, Russia, China, Iran.
You know, it's so easy to play this playing game. It's very much, you know, Machiavellian mindset at the end, but it won't really help the U.S. At the end of the day. And I think the U.S. Response to Corona was very miserable. You know, U.S. is the world's superpower, and it was not really able to contain the virus.
Do you think the media, as I say, is being successful, though, in hiding that level of the crisis? We noticed here that there were Harley Street clinics offering coronavirus tests for the rich. In Saint-Tropez, apparently, billionaires have been getting tests at the expense of the hinterland there in the south of France. Is this the nature of the class war ahead?
I don't think, you know, that the media is controlled in Western society, but the media is definitely biased. In the Western media landscape, it's that everybody is following the leading media voice, and everybody is saying the same. So it could be that at the end of the day, the media is missing the point and not reporting about this coming revolution and the coming class warfare.
What do you make of your successor at the World Economic Forum, arguably, Mark Benioff, chair of the tech company Salesforce, saying capitalism as we know it is dead? No longer can we maximize profits in a way that only fosters climate emergency. Is this the new future, and do policymakers recognize it, or will it be back to ideas of maximizing profits, of obsessions with debt-to-GDP ratios at the expense of the majority?
Capitalism in the old way is definitely dead. We have to rethink capitalism and how our economies work and for whom, potentially toward a new Bretton Woods-style settlement for the entire global economy. Go for a green growth and a new Green Deal, something the European Union actually announced prior to the corona crisis, and we shouldn't forget it right now. We have to reposition capitalism. We have to put a social dimension to capitalism.
Dr. Frank-Jürgen Richter, thank you.
That interview was by Afshin Ratansi on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's simpler than you might think, except for the noise that your electronic devices will create. If you use the internet, listening globally is even easier and noise-free. See the links at this program's website. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website, along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.